Hi, this is Matt Grant, and you're listening to the Malware Report. We have a special guest on today's podcast, in addition to Randy Abrams, to celebrate the Malware Report's 150th episode. Mark Sox is the director of SANS Internet Storm Center. In addition, Mark works closely with government and business stakeholders as part of the National Security Emergency Preparedness Community in Washington, D.C. In November of 2007, Mark was named a member of the Commission on Cybersecurity for the 44th Presidency. Hi, Mark and Randy. Thanks for being here.
Hey, Matt. Glad to be here.
Always great to be back here.
You know, I wanted to start today by discussing your role in helping to thwart cybercrime by working with the U.S. government. Can you tell us a little bit about where we are today and where we might be in 2010 as it relates to government involvement with cybercrime?
Cybersecurity, at least here in Washington, is probably one of the hottest topics next to healthcare. And I'm sure most people are very familiar with the healthcare debate, but hiding back behind it, there's a lot of interest, both up on Capitol Hill, as well as over in the White House and the departments and agencies and others. I think what we're going to see is once the healthcare and the interest overseas, military, as that starts to move forward, cybersecurity is going to come back alive again. This is both good and bad. I mean, we as cybersecurity professionals all want our government to be actively engaged and working with us in the private sector and as a partnership move forward. But sometimes things like this can get out in front of us as well, and we might have well-intentioned people in the government looking to quickly make decisions, put forth bills, do quick things that might wind up hampering what we're up to as well. So we're trying very hard here. Those of us that are in the private sector, and particularly those of us who have extensive experience in the government, to work with our partners within the federal government to make sure that as we do move this forward, we're doing it keeping in mind privacy of individuals, constitutional rights and freedoms, as well as the technical limitations of the networks, and trying better to understand the threat and characterizing where the threat wants to go so that we can counter that and literally bring the internet and other parts of cyberspace back under the control of the users so we can do all those really cool things we were talking about 10, 15 years ago. If you recall, in the mid to late 90s, as the dot-com world was exploding, we had lots of really neat vision. And I think a lot of that will still continue to happen, but we've got to make sure the criminals don't take advantage of it also as we bring all these new technologies out to the general public.
Well, Mark, as you well know, this is the time of the year that those of us in information security get bombarded with what are the top 10 ways that the world's going to end next year? And rather than go down that old path, I'm curious, are you seeing anything that you could say, next year, I see the government making a positive difference in cybersecurity?
I think we will see that, and the government has been making a difference. We need to give credit where credit is due. All along, as you probably recognize over the decades, there has been a lot of government involvement with the development of the internet and with countering the crime problems. I was in government in the late 90s and the early part of this decade, and many of us thought that disruptions and bad things in cyberspace were going to be either nation-state related, you know, countries fighting countries, future world war type of scenario, or in the wake of September 11th, we thought it would maybe shift to being a terrorist type approach, still disruptive, perhaps coming through the networks, blowing up pipelines, causing airplanes to fall out of the sky, things like that. A few people were seeing the potential for cybercrime and also cyber espionage, but most of us in those days were still thinking in terms of the physical effects that could happen from cyberspace disruptions. But since about 2003, 2004, the big shift now has been to the subversion of the networks. In other words, breaking in and stealing things, espionage, spying, identity theft, other types of criminal activity. So the federal government has been reacting to that slower than the private sector can react, of course, because that's just the way it is with large bureaucracies. But in the latter part of the Bush administration, there was a big initiative to respond to the espionage threat. And that initiative is now well underway, but it's only within the federal government, so it's not something the private sector sees very much, unless you're a government contractor or you're doing a lot of work with the Defense Department or others. Now, in the new administration under President Obama, there's a renewed effort to go beyond just protection from espionage, but what can we do to make the networks safer in general? And how can we bring things like broadband and new wireless capabilities and other new technologies, bring them to America, much like what we did back in the 1920s and 30s when electricity had been around for 20, 30 years or so, but it was really only in the industrial urban areas. And there was a big push to bring all electricity to all the rural customers. So now we're seeing that same sort of mindset that says, you know, broadband's a really good thing. The internet is very mature, but it's slow in many parts of America. So let's make more of it available to more people, but let's do it securely. And I think that's what you're going to see in the coming years is a push from the federal government to try and get a faster, cleaner internet out to everybody because of the recognition that this is what the 21st century is about. We are post-industrial. As many of us painfully know, we've outsourced quite a bit of our manufacturing and are continuing to do that. Most of our goods and services are manufactured in other countries. We import them here into the United States. And our economy, in terms of the wealth of the nation, has definitely shifted towards the creation and bartering of information. I mean, look at the jobs that those of us right here on this podcast are in. We're not in a factory assembling car parts. We're putting out and selling information. And so that tends to be what our country is doing. So we're seeing the government recognize that as well. And the way to make this work is to bring the broadband world to everybody. But we have to bring it securely. So to answer your question directly about, you know, what's the next worst thing that happens out there, I don't think we're going to see an explosion on the internet. We're not going to see computers gobbled up by some new botnet. You know, we're not going to see some kind of real crafty new tool that comes out there. One of two things will happen. Either the criminal world will find some very ingenious way to get more value out of the networks. In other words, they're going to find some new subversive tool that we haven't thought of, because the criminals are certainly profit-motivated, and there's a lot of wealth online for them to steal. Or it may turn and go the other direction, which would be favorable for all of us, is that people online, businesses, governments, and others, begin to recognize the threat that this presents to our country and to our economy, and begin to take the networks back and start strengthening them. And like we would say in the physical world, of take a bite out of crime, maybe we can take a bite out of cybercrime. So this coming year, 2010, and maybe into 2011, might actually be a turning point going the other way, so that rather than the networks getting worse and more scary, we might be able to turn the corner and start making them more safer. But it requires those of us in the InfoSec profession to really take this stuff seriously and not just talk about it and go to conferences and write really cool papers and stand up and, you know, beat our chests about how important it is, but begin to really make a difference. And working with the companies and the governments and individuals to move this all forward. I think we can do that. And I believe the administration now is poised to help out to make it happen. But they, too, are limited by budgets. They're limited by the political process. They're limited by things that are very important to the American people, like healthcare, for example, or sending more troops overseas to Afghanistan or to Iraq or other places. Those are competing priorities that compete with cybersecurity. So we have to know that. But luckily for us, we don't need to wait for the government to do things, because cyberspace belongs to everybody. And each of us have a role to play. And all of us working together can make this a safer place.
Over the past year, I've sat on a couple different panels that were hosted by the Department of Homeland Security, which I know you work closely with, and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And the thrust of it really was that the government actually is partnering with the private sector and not only providing some security guidance, but requesting information and feedback to help make this a unified government-private sector attempt at taking back the internet. However, it struck me that in all the sessions, virtually all the speakers came back to, we need to educate people. Do you think?
And you know, Randy, yeah, what you're hitting on is something that it has been a big change here in the last couple of years. There was an initiative late in the Bush administration to increase what we call the public-private partnership through DHS. They published the National Infrastructure Protection Program, the NIP, N-I-P-P. That laid out a common framework, a roadmap for all the different sectors of the economy, the different critical infrastructures and key resources, and how to work with themselves and with government in the mutual protection of all of our critical assets, not just cyberspace. And so, as you say, one of the first things that was recognized was how big the problem is and how few people truly understood it. So that's that education gap. How do we get the word out to everybody? A couple of other things that we've uncovered now in the last year or so is both sides, both government and the private sector, have an incredible amount of information that needs to be shared with each other. From a cyberspace point of view, the government has quite a bit of knowledge about emerging threats, weaknesses, vulnerabilities, intentions of adversaries, and this could be both national threats as well as criminal threats. But by law, they can't share that openly with the private sector. You know, there's restrictions on law enforcement-sensitive information. There's certainly restrictions on intelligence, you know, gathered through the intelligence community. There are cleared individuals within the private sector, but if somebody holding a security clearance gets a full briefing from the federal government on an emerging threat, they can't turn around and pass that information along to somebody in their company who doesn't have a security clearance. So we're working through that. We're trying to figure out how do you take very sensitive government-controlled information and convert it into actionable information that the private sector can do things with. And there's quite a bit of progress being made there. On the flip side, industry, private sector, sees lots of things. And by law, in some cases, by contract in other cases, that information cannot be shared back to the federal government. And that becomes frustrating. For example, back last spring, if you remember the Conficker botnet, which, by the way, is still around, and we've still got several million infected computers, big rumor that on the 1st of April that Conficker was going to cut loose and have lots and lots more infections. DHS wanted everybody to report to DHS, what are you seeing, what's going on, who's infected, particularly what parts of the federal government are infected. But yet the private sector, the ISPs and others that run the networks, by law, cannot report that information to anybody except their customers. And we do this through a privacy law, an electronic privacy law that was enacted back in the 80s. So legally, that information can't be shared, even though we know it's in the best interest of everybody to do that. But privacy comes first. So these are some of the areas that we're working on now in a public-private partnership, and all this is open, by the way. Anybody can participate who's interested. And by the way, participation means that you roll your sleeves up and get involved, that you don't just sit on the sideline and, you know, throw rocks into the arena. But anybody who wants to participate certainly can through what's called their sector coordinating councils. There's 18 of these. You can go to the DHS website and go in the search criteria and just type in sector coordinating council and find the sector that you belong in, join that council, and become part of the process and begin to work with the federal government and work with others in your sector to increase that awareness, to get the education out, to do the public-private partnering that now is starting to gain some momentum here in Washington, which is a very good thing.
It's great to hear that the public and the private sector are starting at least to recognize the importance of working together to combat cybercrime. What about with so many threats coming from overseas? How do we as the U.S. need to work with other countries to try to thwart cybercrime?
So countries outside the United States, and many times we don't see this here as Americans because we unfortunately, our culture, we look at ourselves as ourselves, and very rarely, unless you're a world traveler or you have relatives in another country, rarely do many people step outside of our world and look back at us. But what I've found by traveling and by talking to many friends of mine in foreign countries, there is still a great expectation of the United States to be the world leader, particularly in all things technical and specifically in cyberspace. They expect us to be the ones to stand up to cybercrime. They expect us to figure out how to solve these problems. They expect us to continue to be leaders. unfortunately, as a country, we're not really doing that. We're starting to fail. We're really not in that leadership role that we historically have been in. And this is frustrating other countries because there's that expectation that the United States can do pretty much anything we want to do. So we as a nation have got to come to grip with that. Are we going to lead as we were before? Or are we going to take a back seat? Are we going to partner? What is our role going forward internationally? I think for the planet, the best thing to do, of course, is partnership. There's a lot of strength in other countries, European countries, Asian countries, even African and Middle Eastern countries, Australia, South Pacific, South America. Lots of really good people, good companies, good governments that are thinking about cyberspace and how best to move forward. We in America need to start partnering with and leveraging that expertise. Maybe the leadership role is one of coordinator versus thought leader and, you know, a country that cranks out the new technologies. But this is a big challenge for the administration, particularly because many of Americans would like the administration to come back home, to focus on the United States, to focus on domestic problems, not be so international, don't try and solve everybody else's problems. But as you and I know, cyberspace is a millisecond type of world, and ones and zeros and IP addresses and TCP and UDP and DNS and all the fun stuff that's buried down inside of the internet, those core protocols, they know nothing about human society. They don't know where countries start and stop. They don't respect any religions. There's no ethics boundaries. None of that stuff is there. So we share this as a man-made common thing, and so we all have to work together as mankind to bring it forward into the coming decade. So in to wrap all this long little discussion up, the big role of the United States now in terms of international leadership is trying to, I believe, to be a coordinator and then begin to work with the many countries that do have a lot of expertise to bring that expertise out, weave it together, and then begin to think as an extension of mankind, perhaps, not just an extension of the United States into cyberspace, and allow for the other cultures and the other mindsets. And then, by the way, we're seeing a lot of this with the new internationalization of the domain names, where up until just a few weeks ago, everything online in terms of domain names all had to be in English characters. Now you can see characters that are in Hebrew and Swahili, Arabic, Chinese, Russian, whatever. Doesn't matter now anymore about the character sets. That's great for global languages. It's also outstanding if you're a criminal. It's unfortunate because by making it as global as we have, we're now opening up even more opportunities for criminals to take advantages of human weaknesses. And right, perhaps we could even go deeper into that on another podcast as to some of the new problems that we're setting up by internationalizing even further, which is the right thing to do, by the way, but we create more opportunities for the bad guys.
Yeah, I was just going to say, we could probably do a whole podcast just on the international character set and URLs alone.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Mark, before we let you go, how do you explain to politicians and to Americans who do not spend time on the front lines fighting cybercrime, when you were commissioned to write the cybercrime report for President Obama, how did you explain the severity of this problem?
We looked at it, and it wasn't just me, of course. There was a team of a few dozen of us that worked about 15 months on this project. We searched for some, how do you put it into plain text? How do you put it into layman's terms? And there's many models, many examples. Some were referring to the Roman model, you know, where they built lots and lots of roads. And then the Roman enemies used those very roads to come back in and attack Rome. We are something like that here in America. We built all these digital highways, and now our adversaries are using those digital highways to come back at us. There's other models. The highway model works quite well. But fundamentally, we recognize that there are probably three different levels that we need to think about. There's certainly the political level, and that's when you're talking to a new president, congressmen, senators, and others, you always have to remember the politics. and the politics don't understand the internet. There's other forces, re-elections and things like that, taking care of constituencies. So that all is an important piece. There's the technology side, which is really a very small group of people that fully understand the technologies of how the internet works end to end. If you compare that against all the users, but the technology is important. The technology is what makes all this work. So we've got some technology discussions within the document that we gave to the White House. But the bigger piece of it really is the average American, when you ask them what's the internet, they don't talk about the politics and they don't talk about the technologies. They talk about the content. If Google is not available, or if YouTube is down, or they can't get their email, or Facebook or other popular social networking sites are unavailable, or if voice over IP doesn't work, or I can't stream my video, and you see where I'm going with this, if those applications are not there, then to the average American, the internet is broken. They don't want to hear anything about routers and switches and DNS and packet flows and all that technical stuff.
Exactly.
It's all about the content. And so this is a piece that we have really started to think about. When we say cybersecurity, we need to think about securing the content while we're at the same time working down at that technical level, making sure we don't have keystroke loggers and packet sniffers and man-in-the-middle and all that neat techie stuff. And also from a political angle, you know, making sure that we remember that the policies that are behind this and what it means politically are not lost as well. We got a lot of really good reviews from the White House and others. That report, by the way, is available. You can do a search for it, or we might include a link off the podcast here on how to download it. It's quite lengthy, but there's a lot of good vision inside of it. We've been asked since that report came out, and it came out about a year ago. It was December of last year. We were asked at first, could we produce a scorecard, say 6 months later? This would be last summer. Could we evaluate the administration? How far have they come in executing the plan? We pushed back on that and said, look, this was just a set of recommendations. We are not writing a strategic plan for America, and we're certainly not GAO. We don't come in and do scorecards. But what we're working on now is some of the topics that we just felt we couldn't talk about last year, either because they're too hard to discuss, or maybe they're politically unpopular, or for whatever reason, we just didn't want to go down those roads, at least not too far. We've now spent the last year thinking about how to capture them. And what we hope to do is early next year, early 2010, come out with a supplemental report that addresses some of the other harder topics, some of the things that the administration should continue to think about. And as they get midway through their first term, perhaps start executing on these. Of course, the big piece, and I know we're all waiting on this, is who's going to be the cyber coordinator? You know, who do we turn this over at the White House? Because we certainly don't give it to the president. None of us have any illusion that the president's going to sit there in the Oval Office with a fire in the fireplace and his reading glasses right on, you know, flipping through the report. We don't see that happening. But there really has to be a person. And the White House did make a promise back in May that they would appoint a cyber coordinator. But that coordinator has yet to be named. And I think that is a stopping point for many people. Without the coordinator, government agencies, private sector, others are going slow because they're afraid anything they might do might get changed once the coordinator gets named. So if there's one thing the White House could do right now, would be to name that coordinator. Let's go ahead and move forward, get that individual named and start moving. But for others outside of the White House, our advice has been don't wait on the coordinator. You've got the White House plan from back in May. You've got the recommendations we put together. And there are many other groups that have recommendations that are very good that have come out in the last year. Let's just start executing. Let's do something. And don't just sit here waiting for this person to be appointed and waiting for that to all move forward. And fortunately, you mentioned the Chamber of Commerce and other groups here in Washington, very active in moving this agenda, particularly the education side, getting CEOs and general public, other decision makers, people who are outside of the normal cybersecurity technology circles, getting them informed, getting them educated and moving forward. But all that being said, we still need one person in charge, one person who sets the tone, sets the vision, becomes the guidepost for the federal government when it comes to cybersecurity. And then that person working with the private sector, with academia, with others, in a national approach, you know, a national agenda per se. And I've got good confidence that this person's going to get named very soon, but I'm not going to go out on any limbs naming names or naming dates, because that just doesn't work.
I would be quite shocked if your name wasn't on the list of potential candidates.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, everybody's name that has appeared in the media in speculation has wound up not getting the position. So it's probably better not to name names, not to speculate, not to go out on any limbs, and just let the White House process go through its normal process of appointments. And I understand part of their problem, too, is that the media has labeled this individual the cyber czar. That's
right.
Unfortunate. We really shouldn't use that term. It's cyber coordinator. The term czar has bad feelings here in Washington, and that may be contributing to why we don't have the cyber coordinator named yet, is the pushback with, you know, here's the administration naming yet another czar, and the White House doesn't need that. We in cyberspace and we as Americans, we need the individual, we need the coordinator, the visionary, you know, who can represent the federal government. That person's not a czar, they're a coordinator. And I think the best thing the media can do is to begin calling for the cyber coordinator to be named and drop the word czar. Just take that out of the lexicon completely.
Yeah, quite a while back I blogged about how that was a really, really bad title and it didn't describe what the job is.
Right.
So I'm sure we could talk for hours with the depth of knowledge you have, but I'm also sure you're quite busy. And I wanted to thank you so much for being our special guest on the 150th podcast of the Malware Report.
Well, Randy and Matt, it's been my pleasure, and I hope we can do more of them.
Mark, thanks so much for joining us today on this special edition of the Malware Report. You're right when you say the Internet belongs to all of us, so we all hold a sense of responsibility. To find out more about the links that were mentioned on today's podcast, visit ESET's Threat Center blog at ESET.com. You can also follow the ESET research team on Twitter at ESET Research. This has been Matt Grant. You're listening to the Malware Report.